Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Welcome to Strong Tower Radio on location in Oxford, Ohio, at Miami University. We are in the house, one of the homes of Dr. William McGuffey. Now, McGuffey, you may or may not know, but was an important part of education and the defining of our country when it was still finding its way about 60 years after the founding. And I am here with Jennifer Lorenzetti. And thank you, Jennifer. We've had a wonderful conversation, and now we want to share that with our listeners.
Absolutely. Well, welcome to the William Holmes McGuffey House and Museum here on the campus of Miami University. And before we go into Mr. McGuffey's house, let's talk a little bit about who he was and how he came to be in Oxford. So William Holmes McGuffey is best known as the author and compiler of a series of graded school books known as the McGuffey's Eclectic Readers. But before he came to author those books, he grew up in Northern Ohio and got his education at Washington College in Pennsylvania. He worked his way through college, teaching for a time and then returning to school for a time, so that he got what we would consider his bachelor's degree in about 1824 or 5.
And he didn't leave with much student loans.
Absolutely, none that I know of.
Let's have a word of prayer, and then we're just going to jump in. Such an interesting subject. We all have touched this subject. If you enjoy the Little House on the Prairie books and such, this was just a staple of a period. You couldn't hardly talk about the history society without talking about McGuffey and his eclectic readers. Let's pray. Our great Heavenly Father, what a privilege to be here. Just in the place where this great man, a humble man, a man who improved life for himself, his family, and his culture. Lord, be with us and help us to revel in this wonderful experience. Oh, what a positive story of history, a hero of history. In Jesus' name, amen. So Jennifer, continue your story.
Absolutely. So we are standing here today in the house that McGuffey had built for himself and his family in 1833.
How big was his family at that time?
So at that time, he had just married his first wife, Harriet Spinning, who was a lovely woman who came from Dayton, Ohio.
She was a gracious hostess.
To the best of my knowledge, she was. And those of you who visit the museum, you'll see a wonderful portrait, such a kind face. And she and McGuffey moved into this house as they started to have children. So prior to this, they lived in a frame house, fairly modest.
A wooden house.
A wooden house. And this house that we are standing in today was built of locally made brick, made with the clay of Ohio soil. And it stands with the original walls and original brick so that you can see how it was created. Now, McGuffey was recruited to come to Miami University in 1826.
That was quite a while ago.
It was just a little bit ago, yes.
Almost 200 years ago.
200 years ago next year, we will be celebrating McGuffey's first day of classes. So everyone can think of him being just as nervous as the students and the faculty now still are on that first day.
Now, tell me about this campus. It is absolutely beautiful. If you come down US 127, you just skirt the edge of this campus. And I did that going back of history in about 1980. And since then, 40 plus 45 years, things have changed a bit since then. But this is a huge campus that's kind of hidden here. It's Miami University. Some people designate it of Ohio instead of Florida.
Exactly. But remember, Miami was a university before Florida was a state.
No way.
Absolutely.
Well, history was created here.
Absolutely. We are where America learned to read. And we...
That's a pretty big statement.
Well, I think being the first academic home of William Holmes McGuffey gives us a pretty strong claim to the idea that American culture of the 19th century and the way that Americans handled language got its birth right here, and much of it in this house that we're standing in.
Really?
Yes, yes, absolutely. McGuffey was recruited to come here in 1826 by our very first president, Robert Hamilton Bishop, and he originally taught ancient languages, so Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And over the course of his instruction, not just here at Miami, but teaching in the classroom, teaching young students on the front porch of this house, he understood what it took for everyone from a 3-year-old to a 30-year-old to learn to read. So this gave him a tremendous amount of background about how people learn and what it took to be successful in their subsequent educational journeys.
And what's interesting is that he didn't start out at the college level. He had also been an elementary school teacher in a multi-grade classroom.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, President Bishop reportedly found him teaching in an old smokehouse in Paris, Kentucky. And that's where they met and where Mr. McGuffey got recruited.
So it wasn't a prestigious school. He saw the raw talent of McGuffey.
Absolutely. Yes, and many of McGuffey's contemporaries talked a lot about his skills with language. Obviously, if you know that many languages, and he was able to talk about translation problems, the problems of generating synonyms in different languages. So he had quite a grasp of how languages work.
Well, talk about beginnings, only 60 years after the country started restating that, but you told me this was the frontier. They talk about the Midwest and the frontier. This was the frontier before the Midwest became the Midwest. It's hard to believe that Ohio is the frontier. Please explain a little bit. I'm still trying to get my geography and history together.
Absolutely. So obviously the frontier is simply how far west in the American context that we have traveled. At that point, Ohio had just become a state. And so this particular area was the frontier. This was as far as...
Western Ohio.
Western Ohio was as far as you could buy lots, settle on them. Of course, soon that would become Indiana, Illinois. We would work our way outward. But when the McGuffeys came here, certainly this was the frontier, and much of what you saw on your trip to Oxford with the rolling hills, and hopefully you saw lots of stands of trees, that's very much a microcosm of what the settlers found in large. Lots of trees, lots of growth. It's a very fertile area, so this was a great place to settle and to start a community and a matter of fact, a university.
Well, this is also, I'm taking a little bit of guess, but we're awfully close to the Great Plains. Is this the beginning, or do we have to still go over in current Indiana to get the beginning of the Great Plains?
We still have to go over a bit. The important geographical feature that we need to think about when we think about Oxford, Ohio, which is, if your listeners
Southwestern.
Are not sure, it's southwest and it's near the Indiana-Ohio line. But it is just to the northwest of Cincinnati. So the geographical feature we need to think about is the Ohio River and what that meant for commerce and trade and information exchange and things like that.
And what I've read is this territory, Ohio, Illinois, grew up from the river as south, but it also grew from the north too, and the middle was kind of somewhat desolate. It's so interesting to see the architecture down here. When you see the towns, they tend to have more squares. They do have a defined center, and if it happens to be the county seat, you usually had a courthouse right in the middle of that county square as you come together. That changes if you go into the south and whatever. That's more linear towns and stuff. It's just interesting how time and place and geography change civilization.
Absolutely. Not just city planning, but on the micro level, when you look at a house like you do McGuffey's, we are a federal vernacular style house. And that term just refers to not just the exterior, but how the inside of the house handles visitors and private spaces as you go through it. So it's a very interesting thing just to look at buildings, where they're put and how they work.
And we're on this campus, this house. How close was this to campus? I mean, there are buildings all around me. I mean, three-story, four-story buildings. Beautiful, beautiful campus. It's a very much of a walking campus, friendly. How close was this to the center of the academic community?
It is right across the street from it. When McGuffey came to campus, there were three buildings that constituted the campus proper. One that became known as Old Main, that was the academic building. It had everything from the academic spaces to other gathering spaces, student organization spaces. It had a chapel as well, and we are lucky enough to have four pieces of stained glass from Old Main. And then there were two dorms that today are called Stoddard and Elliott, but they were known as North and South Dorm at the time. This house sits across the street from that main campus.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. What would this area? We're at kind of at the back of the house. There's like a porch that goes on one side of the house. There's multiple doors. And was this area where you receive visitors and guests?
It is exactly that. It is a lobby that was added later so that we are walking in McGuffey's back door. So
Okay. We
are being very familiar with Mr. McGuffey by coming into his private spaces first rather than his public spaces.
That's so interesting. There's different furniture. As I'm looking at this cabinet, it looks like more of a home built, very functional china cabinet, if I might call it that, probably local woods, and very simply built.
Absolutely, and this is very specific to the period. So not everything that we have in the museum belonged to Mr. McGuffey, but we try to also showcase what was going on in southwestern Ohio at the time. So this would have been an example. It is right now in front of where a fireplace was and is, and we will one day restore that.
Awesome. I see a stairwell that goes, so this is a multi-story building.
This is a two-story building. Bedrooms would have been upstairs. When we get into the library, that was added later. There were five families that lived in this house as a private residence over time between the McGuffey's building it and the 1950s. And then in the early 1960s, we became the home of the McGuffey Museum.
It looks like you have some shards of pottery and place settings.
Absolutely. One of our anthropology classes here on campus does an archaeological dig every year or two, depending on the class. The year that they uncovered these china shards was an incredibly lucky year. Of course, what historians and archaeologists love to do is they love to excavate the outhouse several decades after it has been an outhouse.
That's the most productive, rich source.
Absolutely. That's where your trash goes. So in this case, we have a lovely partial rim of a pattern that is black and cream and was called Canova. Now, the Canova pattern of China was made between 1820 and 1840. So that squarely brackets when McGuffey was here. Of course, like all archaeological artifacts, we don't know for sure that
if they owned
them. His China, but we don't even know if he ate off of it, but it was literally in the neighborhood. It was in his world. And that's what's so great about that kind of thing.
Well, we're going into a most, if we could call it sacred, the most important part of this house and affects this. In the center is a is that eight-sided table?
That is McGuffey's octagonal table, which is one of the artifacts that is not just associated with McGuffey, but also with Miami.
Okay.
So, McGuffey had this table built. As you noted, it is eight-sided. It rotates like a lazy Susan.
Can I rotate it?
We actually have it fixed so that
does not happen. That's why I asked first. But it's got felt covering over it, and each side, it's octagon, and it has about 2 feet on every side. Why does it have these eight different slanting slope surfaces? And then in the center, there is other items, the centerpiece in wood is flat. Tell us about it.
Sure. In each one of the eight sides, there is a drawer.
Yes, there is.
So I like to tell people this is the 19th century version of having eight browser tabs open at once.
Okay.
McGuffey reportedly was able to sort through what he wanted in each reader and have a drawer or two for each one. So that is what eclectic means when we say McGuffey's eclectic readers. It means compiled in this context. So he was looking through what belongs in a first reader versus what belongs in a fourth reader.
So it wasn't all of his material. It was period writing and literature. And if he can't, I'm just guessing, yeah, he comes across this thing, he says, that goes into the level one or that three, whatever. And then when he goes to the revision, he may, it looks in that drawer, says, oh, do I still feel that way? Does it still fit? Take it, leave it, whatever.
That is absolutely correct. And the McGuffey readers, especially as you get further along, more difficult as the series goes on, you're more likely to encounter a wide variety of types of readings. So it is not just prose, it is poetry, it is plays, it is sacred, it is secular. There are conversations with different people. There are writings from the founders. There are writings from Shakespeare. This is a complete language arts curriculum, both in that way and in the fact that you can use these in so many ways.
Okay.
You can use the McGuffey readers, yes, of course, to read and to learn to read. But you also can use them for memorization, for speaking, for argumentation, essay writing, handwriting, spelling, diction. These were all things that were beginning to be considered as part of the toolkit that an American would have in order to be successful.
Let me ask you this question just before we go to our first break. So this is is this like a library? I mean, many of these schools, this was the whole spectrum of schools, and many of them were very small. They may not have a library. Is it almost like a library at a grade level for students?
So the way I would explain it is something very flexible for a school or a family to have. Since you can do several different kinds of exercises with these readers, then you don't need to have a set of school books for every student. You don't issue students the first reader as an entire class, and then the second. You can trade them around.
Really?
Exactly, depending on what the student is learning. Same thing for your families. Your families on the frontier weren't buying 5 and 6 sets of McGuffey readers. They were sharing them among the children. So as it turns out, having these eclectic readers made them very, very flexible and very economical when they needed to be.
Wow, we've just opened up Pandora's box, and we'll have to pick that up after the break. We're here on location at the William McGuffey home on the campus of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. We're learning a lot about the period. We're learning about what he's noted for, his contribution to literacy. But we're also kind of learning about history of the time. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio on location. We're at the Dr. William McGuffey's house here, and I have Jennifer Lorenzetti, and she is our guest today, and just opening our eyes to the period that was 60 years into our country. The country was forming, a lot of immigrants, a lot of things going on, and William McGuffey felt the importance. He was an educator, worked, had taught in multi-grade classrooms, elementary level, and he's been asked to come to the college, and much of his important part of literacy, you said something very important, that something about literacy is kind of, how did you say that?
I believe you're referring to the definition of literacy was changing at that point in America's history. And what I mean by that is that prior to this point, literacy was not a concept. Illiteracy was a concept. So that meant somebody who was absent book learning is the way we would think of it.
Okay.
And then, of course, that evolved to have the word literacy to mean somebody who did have the education.
Okay.
Literacy was very much a group activity. You wanted somebody or several somebodies in your group who could read out loud, who could answer questions. The reading materials of the founding time, for example, the New England Primer, was essentially a catechism. It was essentially a Calvinist catechism. And so that means it's mostly questions and answers about Christian doctrine. There were several other books that were not catechisms, but they were very, very focused on speaking. So literacy was a group speaking concept at that point. About the time McGuffey was coming to Ohio and asked to write his readers, the definition of literacy was changing and developing. So what literacy became is more what we think of as literacy.
It's book learning and reading.
It's the ability to read. It's the ability to digest.
Comprehend,
but also speak, pronounce, argue, debate. These are all things that are part of literacy at that point. McGuffey just happens to be at that juncture when he is writing his readers. So that is one of the ways that they are very different from the readers that came before.
Very good. So take us, we've just walked into this library at the McGuffey House. We have the eight-sided table where he had a drawer for every level. What else is significant? You have a number of books here. You have some nice pretty cover ones, and then you had some that are faded and old.
Which you are welcome to pick up. Anybody who visits us is welcome to pick up a reader from the octagonal table and take a look. One of the great things about the McGuffey Reader Series is just how popular and how long-lived it is. So the McGuffey readers, the original editions were written between 1836 and the early 1840s. They were revised a number of times, once in McGuffey's lifetime and then subsequent times after his death. They're still in print today. Some of your listeners who homeschool
Yes.
probably have used McGuffey readers. And those who haven't, you can hop on your favorite online bookstore and buy yourself a set if you wish. So over this period of time, over about 100 years, the McGuffey readers sold, we estimate, between 120 and 150 million copies. In their heyday, they were selling 350,000 copies per year.
Wow. It was the most popular textbook.
Yes, it was. And even if your listeners have not picked up a McGuffey reader, you've seen references to it. If you have read the Little House on the Prairie series, Laura is asked to come to the front with the fifth reader's class. That was a McGuffey's reader. And that is true for most of the 19th century stories that happen on the frontier as it progresses westward across the United
If you didn't include the reader, you weren't in the cultural context.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the great
things. You didn't have validity or authenticity if your story didn't include this.
I think that's true. One of the great things about the readers is that they're a recognizable touch point for us when we have 18th and 19th century story. They're a great touch point for us when we have 19th century stories. And one of the things about this reader series is that it encapsulates a lot of the values or virtues, I would prefer to say, that were expected of a successful American. We talked about Laura Ingalls Wilder and how she has a number of stories about success being based on honesty or charity. These came from the McGuffey's readers, or at least were reflected there and reflected in her work. The McGuffey's readers have an assortment of stories that emphasize being charitable, being honest, being as well educated as you can, owning up to your own mistakes. And they are very deliberate in saying that if you want to be a success, and in some cases, an extreme financial success, this is how you will do business. So seeing this as a lens into what American culture was looking like as we proceed across the landmass, as the opportunities look almost infinite, this is what America wanted to be.
It was a brand or a culture unto itself.
Yes.
And also was copied, if not whatever, stolen in some respects.
I think what happened was that these were so effective that other authors used them as a model. So you will see a lot of 19th century readers and what we would think of as science books, they're still readers, mathematics books that follow this kind of progression. So you can't help but think, oh, this looks like a McGuffey's reader. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they set out to recreate one as much as this was a way of educating people. This was a pedagogical structure that worked very well.
Awesome. We're here in the library at the McGuffey House. I see some posters here. There's got to be a story. The McGuffey Reader Charts. What's that all about?
Absolutely. And I remember not these particular ones, but...
they look a little bit old and faded, or whatever the term is.
And I will emphasize to your listeners that I am not old and faded just quite yet.
That's right.
But these are literally, as they say, they are reading charts. This is a concept that has been used throughout history. It has been used as far back as the Middle Ages, probably before that. You can put a set of reading charts at the front of the room. Obviously, your primer class or your youngest students are sitting in the front, so maybe they don't need a primer at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe what they need is to sit and look at the letters or the simple 2 and 3 letter words, and then they will be called to the front to recite.
Could you open up with it? It has a nice picture of two people reading, or it looks like two girls, and you're pulling open that chart there. It's about two and a half feet wide, and then it's about 3 feet long. And lesson two, DPTR, Dan and a trap, Nate and Ann, a rat and a trap, Ann and Dan ran.
One of the things that is so well thought out about this kind of reading chart is that it starts out with the consonant sounds and the consonant blends that a student is going to learn. So the D, P, TR, DP, and TR respectively. Then how do you pronounce the words that might be new? Dan, and, trap. Then they're used in sentences, a rat and a trap. Ann and Dan ran. So we have a little story there about Ann and Dan seeing a rat in a trap. Then we have other words that relate to the same lesson in smaller print. And at the bottom, we have an example of handwriting. So the students looking at lesson two here can do a number of exercises without ever picking up a reader.
Yes, I see that. And then on the back side here, you have a script.
Exactly. And
we have to reteach that.
And actually, I've read a good amount of research that suggests that handwriting, cursive writing, does in fact help you retain information. So that is a good skill. This was a time in the country as well, though, that handwriting, cursive handwriting, is becoming slightly more simple. We're moving from very few people needing to write. If you think of the founders and who needs to write at the time of the Declaration of Independence.
You have a scribe.
You might have a scribe. Lawyers, perhaps doctors, clerks, obviously university professors, but the rest of us could get by with somewhat less handwriting. People could write, but maybe somewhat less. By the time we get to McGuffey's era, you are needing to write more commonly as a middle class person, and also you're needing to write faster.
Really?
Yes.
Faster surprises me, but you're basically, I get the idea, the elites did it, and now it's coming into the middle class, and it's becoming across the whole culture.
Exactly. And we can think about that with any kind of literacy we think of today. Think of computer literacy, digital literacy, and we talk about early adopters versus late adopters. So who was the first person to have an electronic tablet versus now it feels like we all have them. It doesn't mean that they're not in the culture. It doesn't mean that people don't know the basics, but for them to pervade across the culture takes a little bit of time.
And you have a advanced manuscript tablet, Palmer method. And my mother said that my grandfather had a beautiful handwriting in the Palmer method. And if I looked at my grandfather's handwriting in the Palmer method, then my mother's was less Palmerish. And then we look at mine, and then you look at the other. It's interesting how handwriting, you could almost tell which generation you were based on your handwriting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a number of volumes here that I can tell the generation of the owners and users based on how they sign their name, or at least as a historian, I can make a fairly good guess. Palmer came into vogue when you needed a faster kind of handwriting, and it started to make sense to learn to print and then write cursive. My generation did something called Dennilian, which had the same purpose.
So it's been a while, and I kind of gone to the block style printing just for clarity and readability, but the Palmer, I forgot about that, script is faster. You don't pick up your pen as often, and you just keep on writing.
That's correct. And that creates a feeling for you. So you're seeing your words appear on the page. You're feeling them happen in your hand. So for those who think a little bit about learning methods and learning styles, you've got both visual and kinesthetic going on, often when you also have auditory because you're listening to a lecture. So that's a very powerful way to draw in a number of different learning types.
Rather than just looking at the PowerPoint.
Absolutely.
Where should we go at this moment?
Why don't we go into the dining room and we can take a look at the portraits that we have of William Holmes McGuffey and his first wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And McGuffey, as we see in this portrait, he's in perhaps his mid to late 30s here.
Okay.
He was a very strong-faced man, strong nose, strong features. You can really see the Scottish influence from both his mother and his father. He was noted for having a high forehead, and as many people are, so he's in great company. And he was very formal in how he dressed. So when he went out and about Oxford and about the campus,
he wasn't in sweats.
He was not wearing pajama pants at all.
Okay.
And this is his wife, Harriet Spinning. You can see she's a very delicate woman. Apparently, he loved the lacy bonnet that she's wearing in this portrait that has these beautiful pink bows on it. And so her portrait was done in one of his favorite pieces of headgear that she had.
And these portraits are about the size as those posters are. Yes. All of 2 feet wide and 3 feet high, and they are painted. They're not a photography and a photograph.
No, McGuffey left Oxford before photography was announced, so Louis Daguerre gave his speech about the development of the first fixed photography in 1839. So McGuffey just missed it by leaving Oxford in 1836.
Oh, okay. So a beautiful bureau. I call a bureau, but...
This is a sidebar.
Sideboard.
And this is essentially... this is a sideboard. It is a Hepplewhite style sideboard. It is all mahogany with mahogany veneering, so you can see the wonderful burling all around the front.
Of the grain,
yes. Mostly original hardware, we believe. And this belonged to the university's first president, Robert Hamilton Bishop. The story is that he brought this sideboard from the east coast of the United States to Kentucky, where he met McGuffey, and he did so in a wagon over unpaved roads.
And it's still intact today.
And we still have the wonderful delicate legs that belong on a Heppel White style piece of furniture. So congratulations to President Bishop.
Absolutely. Is it, when they call a sideboard, is that because you set the food and before you served it to the table?
Exactly. And there may be some regional differences. We call this a sideboard just because of the Heppel White style and what you would call it in that context.
It kind of curves.
It has kind of a fluted or ruffled front. Your listeners may see a similar piece of furniture in their own house called a buffet.
Yes.
That you put dishes on and somebody can come and get what they want.
Very good. Let's take a little break here. We're here at the William McGuffey House on Miami University of Ohio in Oxford, Ohio. And Jennifer is our tour guide. We're having a wonderful tour and really understanding our history much better. We'll be back. I'm Tom Mazur after this break. Stay tuned.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
This is Strong Tower Radio on location. I'm Tom Mazur, your host, and I'm with Jennifer Lorenzetti. And we're having a wonderful time. Our eyes are being opened to the time and period 60 years after this country was founded. We're on this campus of Miami University in Dr. William McGuffey's house. He did a lot to advance literacy. We just came from the dining room and from the library. We're right now in what room?
We are in what we call the history room, which would have been the McGuffey's front bedroom. But what we use this room for is largely Miami University history and then how Mr. McGuffey fits within that context.
Now, we need to explain this. Many people associate the term Miami with Florida. How is it there is Miami in Ohio?
Great question. The word Miami just means downriver is what it means. So most instances of things that sound like Miami, especially in the Ohio area, in the Midwestern area, come from that particular derivation.
Versus upriver.
As opposed to upriver, absolutely. Now, where we like to draw a connection is that one of the native peoples who lived on this land prior to the 1800s was the Miamia people. They are now the Miamia people of Oklahoma. And that is a recognized Native American tribe. They had developed this area and stayed somewhat in this area until some of them sold their land to the American government, but then later some were forcibly removed and taken to Oklahoma. So Miami has always been very proud of remembering that there really wouldn't be a Miami University if the Miamia hadn't been on this land.
That's true. While we're thinking about this, we aren't that far from the canal. What was the canal along, there's a canal right along the south. We probably won't go there, but canals were a big part of the development of the West, the East, and they saw the benefits of the Erie Canal and the Ohio Erie canals and such was, and it goes right along the western border of. They were hoping to have great prosperity to get product to market at a lower cost by water.
Absolutely, absolutely. Both canals and later on the railroad were the first human-made large-scale attempts to echo what you were previously doing generally with water, generally with the river networks. So that allowed for a lot more flexibility, but really we can't forget the role of the rivers in an area like this.
Absolutely. So this is the library or the museum part. Tell us, there's so many things here. Every wall I look at has history.
Well, we could certainly spend the next couple of hours in here, but we won't do that to your listeners. I will point out a couple of things to put this in a Miami University context for you. And one of them is our four beautiful pieces of hand-blown stained glass.
I didn't know you could hand-blow stained glass. I thought you just kind of laid it out and poured it or something.
Well, absolutely, there are different techniques that are beyond my ability, but we can certainly see some of the marks from the hand blowing, and of course the larger a piece gets, the more likely you are to cut out something that's relatively flat. These came from a company that is still in business in Cincinnati.
That's amazing. What a history. I want to go visit that place.
I do as well. I'm going to, as a matter of fact. But these came from the chapel at Old Main, which was our original academic building. So on the second floor, we had this beautiful chapel that was lined down both sides and at the apse end with these beautiful stained glass windows, rose windows at the top of the larger windows. And when the light streamed in, it was just magical. And I know this not just from photography, but because every morning I get to walk in here and see what it would be like, which is one of the perks.
And it's a wonderful window. It's 2 feet wide and it's all about 7 feet tall. You have round circles, blues and yellows, and then you have some curved greens, and then you kind of have a four-piece, I'll call it a flower, or maybe it's even a cross, a stylistic cross.
It's a quadrifoil.
Wow. I learned that today. So many beautiful things here.
And this is what our Miami students got to look at every day, because there was a period where the men of Miami went to chapel every day. But we can't forget that at Miami or in Oxford, there were four other institutions of higher education, three of which were female, and they also used the chapel at Old Main. Mr. McGuffey was a Presbyterian minister, as were the first seven presidents of Miami University. So they took turns preaching not just at Old Main, but also going to the female institutes, preaching at churches both in our town and in the area. So everybody was exposed to the thoughts of all of these ministers, as well as to one another.
Now, I saw Camden College. Did that happen to be a women's college?
That was not.
Okay.
That was not. We had Oxford Female Institute. We have Oxford College for Women. We have Oxford College for Women. And then we had Western College for Women that was modeled on Mount Holyoke. And it became part of Miami as late as 1974.
Well, that just seems like this was a hotbed of education. Is there a reason for this? What was the impetus?
Absolutely. This was a hotbed for education for a lot of the reasons that we were talking about with McGuffey himself. But we were entering a time where the value of education was seen. And one of the bits of research that I enjoy very much is that the reason we have so many female institutes or had in the 19th century was A, part of a national trend, but B, because the professors who came here to teach at Miami wanted their daughters to get the same level of education as their sons. And so they were teaching at Miami and they might be teaching at Oxford College as well. So the women were getting a very similar, if not the same, education, which I think really makes Oxford unique in the mid-19th century.
Oh, that is marvelous. Anything else in this room that we want to cover?
I think one of the things that I would draw your attention to is a painting by a local artist named Marston Hodgen. So Hodgen was the chairman of the art department in a huge chunk of the 20th century. But the one that I am pointing to is called The Three Aradelphians, and It shows the Oxford Cemetery and three gravestones that are tall and spired. And these are gravestones for three young men who died around the same time as one another, different causes. But you ask yourself, why are they the three Aradelphians? At the time in the country, debate was a spectator sport. And there were a lot of debate societies on different campuses. We had two of them, the Aradelphians and the Union. And they would set a topic, research, debate one another for the town to see or the campus to see, as the case may be. And they were such good friends, and this made such tight bonds that the center gravestone is engraved with Vale mi frater, which is Latin for farewell my brother.
Ah, and it's a wonderful painting. It's in landscape and about the same size of 2 feet high and about 3 feet wide. I see some statues or some busts of you have one of McGuffey.
Absolutely, we've got one of McGuffey, and it is sitting in front of what is probably the most popular painting of Mr. McGuffey. He is sitting, he's middle-aged there, I would say in his 40s.
He has his professor spectacles on, and
yes,
he's looking.
Brown professor spectacles, and he is sitting and reading a book. And this is the pose that you will see if you go out into campus. There is a statue at McGuffey Hall, which is our College of Education, and it shows McGuffey with the children at his feet.
Oh, yes.
The other bust that we are very proud of is a plaster bust made by the famous 19th century artist Hiram Powers. And this is of Robert Hamilton Bishop, the university's first president. The story goes that the Aradelphian Society was so admiring of President Bishop that they wanted him looking down on them while they researched and debated and studied. So they commissioned this bust from Hiram Powers and brought it home, and it sat in the rostrum above the desks in their hall.
The clothes that he has looks more like a Greek clothes rather than a Western suit and tie.
Absolutely. This is a period of time, you've mentioned that the country was 60 years old. So we didn't have a lot of pedigree in this country, and we knew it. So what we wanted to touch back on was Greco-Roman traditions and the traditions of democracy, education, classical values. And so it was not at all uncommon for you to do a bust or a statue of somebody of significance and put him in Greek style robes to indicate that he's a virtuous, well-educated man.
And he is among that number, or to be thought of similar.
Absolutely.
Well, in our last remaining moments, so what can we touch on? Are these households here? Are these McGuffey's households?
So some of these are different This is a watercolor, obviously, and some of the photography. But part of what we have here at the McGuffey Museum is literal photographic or illustrative contextualization of the Miami experience, by which I mean we have these photographs of what we call Slant Walk, which is still on the campus today, and probably they beat that path in about 1810. So one of the things I love is walking down Slant Walk and thinking about how many years now that students have been walking down that path, and I'm walking down it as well. And I know a lot of people feel the same.
A touchstone of history.
Yes, and that's one of the great things about Miami is that we're very knowledgeable and respectful of our own history, and we are still very proud of teaching people the values, the virtues, the basic components of success that you're going to need as you go out in the world. That has changed over time. It's going to keep changing. But we're still going to keep honoring that you come here, and when you come out as a Miami alumnus or alumna, you're part of a specific group that will always have a connection.
Hmm. And again, what a beautiful campus. Every time I've driven, again, I was saying going back to the early 80s, I was just impressed. Even if you come through at night and the campus is closed, the architecture speaks to you.
Absolutely. It's a completely different place at night with everything lit up and the students working in their labs and studios and dorms. It's a wonderful place, and I'm very blessed to get to be here every day.
What do you want to leave our listeners with? One is if they ever come to Miami University here in Oxford, but if they never come, what influence should they still receive at a distance?
Well, first of all, I would definitely like to invite your listeners to come visit our website. We always have our hours on the website, or if you're coming for a particular vacation, you can always give us a call and we'll make sure that we're open for you. But what I am hoping that people take away is the necessity for this kind of widespread education for all that pervaded the 19th century and that carried not just the skills of reading and writing, but also the picture of what we wanted to become as Americans.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. Jennifer, thank you for taking of your time, opening up the library, the museum, the house for our listeners. And we definitely have been blessed by our experience being here.
Thank you so much for coming. I've really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Strong Tower Radio On Location with Tom Mazur, a part of the Strong Tower Radio Network. You may look at this program, refer it to other of your friends and associates to hear the delightful program, the visit that we had here today, as well as a number of years of programs that you will want to become acquainted with and always treasure. Again, this is Strong Tower Radio Network. God bless. Bye now.